CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 94 with Dr. Rupa Wong, achieving your best in all aspects of your practice and your life. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, a social media sensation, and of course, an Ivy Leaguer, an ophthalmologist, a fantastic surgeon, all over social media, Dr. Rupa Wong. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me. I can't wait. I'm excited.
Yeah, so I actually have seen a lot of your stuff come up on my social media. You're prolific, but I think it seems like you're aimed at really kind of educating the masses, the whole people, everyone.
Absolutely. And it's a little bit different, I think, than a lot of the content that gets pushed out by our academies or even by my Pediatric Ophthalmology Association. They're always geared towards educating med students or even residents and your channel, right? Yeah. To teaching people that are younger than you, mentoring in that way. And I started out my social media doing that. And then I just realized there's a bigger platform because there's so much misinformation out there, you know, LASIK, all sorts of things that people don't understand the true, you know, the true facts behind it. And then if we're not out there educating the masses, then who else is?
Right. In fact, one of the videos that I remember yours from a while ago was, can eating pineapple decrease my floaters?
Yes.
And I'm like, who else than a Hawaiian to answer this?
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's so interesting because some of these questions seem as if they're pretty easy for us to answer, but they are, if you think about it, they're the questions that your patients are almost too embarrassed to ask. And that's where I started my YouTube channel. I had seen a patient of my husband's and, you know, I'm checking her for cataracts, glaucoma, the whole thing. And then at the end, she's kind of embarrassed. She asks, all right, you know, those magnetic lashes, are those safe? Can I use them? I'd never even heard of magnetic lashes before. She sent me the link that was on Good Morning America. And that was actually one of my very first YouTubes that I did. It's like, all right, this might actually, some people might be worried about that. To us, it seems pretty simple to explain and to understand, but it addresses a need for that people are having. So may as well educate on there.
Now, forgive me for being stupid. I don't even know what are magnetic lashes. I don't even know.
Okay, yeah. So I'm educating you, but the beauty aspect now. It's a magnetic eyeliner. And then instead of a false lash, like a fake eyelash that you put on with glue and then adhere it to the skin right above the lashes, you use a magnetic eyeliner. It has these tiny little magnets. And it just kind of clicks into place there. So
the eyeliner, like pigment, has magnetic particles?
Yeah, it has iron oxide in it. So people were concerned, is that safe? Is that not? Actually, a lot of eyeliners have iron oxide in them anyway, just for pigment. So it's not that big of a deal. It's just a little bit more.
Wow. I had no idea. Now, you mentioned you work with your husband. Take me through your whole path in ophthalmology. So I did a little of my own homework. I know you went to Duke for undergrad and then Cornell for med school. But how'd you choose ophthalmology? Why? When you were in med school?
So when I was in med school, I actually did a 2-month rotation in India, but not at Arvind, where everybody goes in residency. Mm-hmm. My family had connections in Chennai to a private eye hospital called Shankar Netralaya. So when I was very young, like 13, which is kind of crazy. You have kids, wow. I have kids. I was 13. I babysat like 3 children at one time, which is a little crazy. I would never let that happen to my kids. But I literally was babysitting a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a baby. And the 4-year-old had amblyopia. And I was so fascinated just by the optics of it. She would wear a patch. I didn't really understand. So that kind of stuck with me. I certainly didn't enter medical school thinking I was going into ophthalmology or pediatric ophthalmology. I knew I wanted to work with kids. So I actually thought, my mother's a child psychiatrist, I thought I would go into child psychiatry or pediatric oncology or cardiology. And then I realized I don't like general peds at all. I found it extremely boring. And I wanted to be a surgeon. So then it narrowed it to peds opto or peds ENT. I was pretty much set going into residency that I wanted to fellowship train in pediatric. So I did a 2-month rotation with a woman who had actually done her residency and her fellowship here in the US, I think at Kentucky and then at Iowa for her peds opto fellowship, and then gone back to India to practice. So I worked with her. Yeah, it was great. I did clinical stuff with her. I mean, they're seeing 1,000 patients a day. You know how it is. You think, I mean, especially for a desi, like born here, you think, oh, I'm going to go to India and I'm going to be, you know, it's not going to be anything like these esteemed institutions I've been at, right? And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, the kinds of patients they're seeing, the complexities, the sheer volume, you just learn a ton. And so I was hooked. That's what interested me in pediatric ophthalmology. Then I matched in residency, stayed in New York, met my husband, who was a resident as well.
Oh, cool. Fellowship trained.
Yeah. So he was actually a year below because he took a year off in between college and medical school. So I was his, we used to have the buddiest system the first month of residency. So I was his senior buddy, and he was extremely scared of me because I was like rushing around and school in the radiology. He's like, I just remember you saying, dirty fat, look at the dirty fat. Checking for, a CT. So it's pretty funny. Somehow we started dating. And then I went to do my fellowship training at Boston Children's, and they offered me a job after fellowship. And it worked out because he did his cornea fellowship at OCB. And I thought we would stay in Boston, but he's a Hawaii boy, and that those winters were just not having it for him. So,
he's originally from Hawaii.
He's from Hawaii. His family's been here for generations. So he really just wanted to come back.
Well, that's not a bad move. I think the winters in Oahu are much nicer than those in Boston.
Much nicer, for sure.
But then you guys decided to just start solo practice.
So it's interesting. So what we were doing, like, people really don't have large group practices. It's very different practicing medicine on Hawaii than compared to the rest of the country. I think it's the way medicine was practiced probably about 50 years ago. It's a bigger town, but it's still really small town. We see patients on Saturdays. People really do solo practice, one or two doctors. So we were calling around trying to find a place for a cornea specialist and a peds person, and nobody was hiring, not even the larger HMOs. So we bought a practice from a physician that was retiring, and we got very lucky because he's very well respected. He was just a great comprehensive general ophthalmologist. And you don't really think about that when you're buying initially, but the reputation he had, the way he cared for patients, the patients we inherited were just all great. But to be honest, we ended up, the patient demographics, they changed when we got on board. I mean, maybe 30%, 18 years later, 16 years later, have stuck with us the whole time. You know, people change. They want to be able to choose their doctor. But it was at least a great way to not have to build everything from scratch for the two of us with zero salary. We had some income coming in right off the bat. So that was helpful. But if we hadn't moved to Hawaii, I would have never, ever started a private practice. I mean, I was on the academic track. That's kind of what you learn in residency and training and fellowship. If, as chief resident, it's just, you go the academics. It seems to be the path of least resistance in some ways.
Right. So he's doing, I guess, anterior segment, cataract, cornea, yep, refractive, glaucoma, maybe general ophthalmology. And then you're doing mostly peds, adult strabismus, or you're doing combinations?
So mostly, it's funny, my clinic patients are probably 70% peds, but almost all of my surgery are adult strabismus. So the ones that I get for adult strabismus, that was just when I came out here, they're already, surprisingly, Oahu is kind of saturated with pediatric ophthalmologists. There were four others here on the island, and that's too many. They already had the connections to the pediatricians. So I made connections to the other ophthalmologists and to the optometrist. And so I started getting a lot of complicated adult strabismus patients since I trained in adjustable suture technique. And that became my bread and butter. And that's what I do. And I enjoy it now. But in the beginning, it was scary because doing a simple BMR on a baby is a lot easier than a thyroid ophthalmopathy, cranial nerve palsy reoperation, which is what I do. But I had great mentors, and I would completely text my old chairman, David Hunter, and some of my mentors the first 2 years out of practice. Okay, what do I do here? What do I do there?
Oh, that's so great to have that.
Yes, definitely. We have a very close fellowship community. And since I was on faculty there, they all get together. I mean, everyone does that at Economy, but it's just, they're really close, that they will text you immediately, get on the phone with you, talk to you. And I don't think people realize when they're in training, what you learn that first 5 years out.
Right.
Your surgical skills. I mean, you think that you're a good surgeon when you come out, but you really, just your clinical decision-making, just hands down, so much better. Your ability to think on the fly when something happens, right? When you're doing an anterior segment or when I have a pulled in two syndrome, which is when the muscle splits because it's so fibrotic from thyroid ophthalmopathy. These things happen, and that's what makes you a good surgeon, not can you do the bread and butter, right?
Right, the tough case. And you're right. You finish your training, you think, I'm so good, until you start practicing. You think, wait a minute. Oh my gosh, there's so much left to learn still.
Yes. Absolutely. And I learned from everyone when I was still doing anterior segment surgery in the very first year, because I didn't have much of a peds practice. So I went back to doing just adult cataract surgery and comprehensive stuff. And I learned a lot from my reps. Some of those reps, I mean, we have a rep on island that had been doing for 30 years in the OR with just great people. And he was like, oh, why don't you try OptiCapture here? Why don't you try, oh, hey, this, you know, even in my peds case, he'd come in, help me with the settings. I think that's another place that people also don't think about, but you can learn a lot from non-physicians as well.
Yeah, the whole team actually, right?
Yeah.
I mean, from even me now, I don't know how many tens of thousands of surgeries later, if I'm doing a case and my scrub tech, who's probably scrubbed 10,000 cases with me, she'll say, doctor, do you want me to get this instrument for you? The answer is always yes. Because she's looking at the monitor thinking like, what are you doing? No, you need to do something different. And you just trust me, like, whatever she says, like, yes, I think that's a great idea. Let's have it.
I love it. And plus, I mean, then people have resources like yours, which we didn't have 16, 18, 20 years ago, right? There, I mean, YouTube just wasn't as big as it is now. The ability to learn. I see my husband watches your videos like during lunch breaks. And, oh, he totally, he's a big fan, total big fan of it. He was very excited that I was doing it.
Yeah, I kind of made my whole focus is just, I want Midas to be only ophthalmologists. So I don't make any videos oriented towards patients. And I don't expect a patient to actually watch a surgery, which a lot of them find gross. And then I don't want to try to explain to you what does capsulorhexis mean. That's not for me. I want to talk to surgeons.
Yes.
But yours is a much wider reach. I was seeing like, you know, I have 70,000 YouTube subscribers. You got almost double that. But then I look at your videos like, well, okay, wow, though. The content is really, it's like stuff that all my friends who are not ophthalmologists would love to watch.
Yes, exactly. It's the stuff at when you're at a party and someone asks you those questions.
It's the questions. Like, oh my gosh! That every one of my non-medical friends asking me, even my friends are physicians but not ophthalmologists. Can I ask you about floaters? Can I ask you about this and the diet? I've never been asked about this magnetic lashes though, but now I know.
Okay, but now you know the answer.
Well, I also noticed on the social media, you also have a lot of just fun stuff with your kids. Now, my kids are a little older. They're both in their 20s. They're both in med school. I won't talk too much about them because they like the privacy. They absolutely insist, like, do not ever show me or mention me on your social media. And so I respect that. You're okay to do that.
Well, so it's interesting. I started social media about 6 years ago and had a discussion with my husband. And we, you know, because for me, my target audience is the millennial mom. I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist. I also do a lot of adult strabismus. They're going to find me just through Googling. But really, when I make content, I'm thinking about that 35 to 45 year old woman. And they like the content to know, hey, I'm a mother too. So we talked a lot about what would be appropriate, what's not. And then honestly, I think my daughter was 5. They can tell me if they want to be, I would never force them to be in a picture. Mm-hmm. Do you not want to do this picture? Fine. I once got approached and I did a brand campaign maybe about 4 years ago for a really big eye company. And they wanted my kids to be in it because it was contact lenses for kids. And so I told them, well, you need to create a separate contract for them. They get paid separately. It's not a ton, but I still want them to feel like they've got a decision whether or not they are in this content. Yeah, so I told the kids like, hey, they're going to pay you $200 to be in a picture. Do you want that? Oh, yeah. Then it's also less fighting for me to get them in the picture. Because I don't want to fight with them to do something. I mean, I will fight with them to be in the holiday picture. That's our, you know, we send out the holiday cards when they were little. Terrible. But, you know, that's always just been a really open discussion. And then you'll probably notice my sophomore in high school, he's like hardly ever in any social media because his friends are on social media. He doesn't want to be on my social media.
Mom, you're so embarrassing.
It's completely. And interestingly, my middle son was also the same. Wait, until I had a couple of videos, interestingly, go viral recently with him in it. And now he says, oh, all my friends have been finding me in the lunch line and texting me pictures that they saw. Todd, your mom is famous on TikTok. So now he's actually more okay with being on it. But for a very long time, it was just my daughter because she loves that stuff. She loves communicating. So people thought that I just had the one kid, which was fine. They'd forget I had the two older boys.
Well, the tough part you have with your daughter is when she gets paid, you tell her, I'm going to put it into a Roth IRA because you earn this working.
And then she'd be like, no, but I want it now. I don't want to wait till I'm 65.
I know. Well, so you know what they did with their money from the account was from the brand deal? They pooled their money and they bought a Nintendo Switch. So that there was what they did with it. I said, you guys can decide what you want or else it's going into your 401k, which we have for that.
That's fun. That's very interesting. Now, one of the other topics you covered, which is actually super important, you talk about your target audience is women or families, let's say 30s and 40s with younger kids, is myopia.
Yes.
Is sky high now? And are we going to be the next Singapore, Hong Kong with like 90% myopic patients? What's going to happen here?
I mean, we're heading that direction. And especially, you know, I got interested in myopia management because I'm in Hawaii. We have a very large Asian population. We know about the genetics. There seems to be, for whatever reason, these loci that Asian individuals are more myopic in addition to the risk factors, the lifestyle risk factors of the extra studying and the tutoring that they're doing in places like Korea and Singapore. I mean, we're lucky, at least in Hawaii, I can do outdoor time, which, you know, has been shown to be beneficial. So they get
2 hours a day outside.
2 hours a day outside. But we are heading that direction. And your kids are older. There's a med school, but mine's a sophomore. So he's thinking about college and all of the things that kids have to do now to even just get into college. It's insane. It's not like 30 or 40 years ago. I hate to say we're dating ourselves, but it really isn't. So the amount of studying, the rigor of the academic course, I think they're on, not just on screens, but I think their schoolwork is more intense. And then they're also on this, right?
On their phone, on their iPad from like age 2 and beyond. Yeah.
So that's what I try to do. So I'm speaking to those millennial moms. I mean, initially, everybody was just educating their kids. They thought, oh, well, if it's an educational program, it's fine for the kids to do 2 hours a day when they're 3 years old. It's absolutely not. You know that.
Yeah, it's funny. A friend of mine, I was hanging out with him and his family, and his 16-year-old daughter comes up to him, 16, and she says, Dad, can I have 30 more minutes? She gives the phone to him, and he enters a password that allows 30 more minutes of screen time. I'm like, whoa.
That's
my kid okay. had me. Old from a young age, I had no such ability to do that.
Okay, so do you want to hear? And our kids, they're used to it. So my oldest is, I have my daughter's 11, my middle son 13, oldest 15. We use a Wi-Fi app called Eero, and we use Bark. They have to request for screen time, even my 15-year-old, even for Google searches, for everything, because there's a way to Google search something and get onto a YouTube and down the rabbit hole for hours and hours. And especially for my oldest son with, you know, two of my kids are neurodivergent. It's, you know, that dopamine rush. It's even, I'm glad with my ADHD that I didn't have phones when I was younger. I don't think I would have studied. I mean, there's something that really taps into that specifically for ADHD kids. So, you know, with him, my oldest, we have a discussion. You know, you've had trouble managing your screen time and you don't get your homework done and you're not studying. You decide what kind of student you want to be, will help you. And for the younger two, it's not even a discussion. It's, this is what it is. That's the law. We shut off their Wi-Fi at 9 p.m. If they're still doing homework, they have to request for it. So we want quality sleep is important. No devices. They can't have them in their bedroom. They don't charge overnight in their bed. So we have a lot of these rules about screen time. We've never had screens at the dinner table. We've never taken an iPad with our kids to restaurants. We took bunches of puzzles and, you know, 3D things, but never, those are just the things that we built up from a really young age. And that was important because I could see the literature from a long time, you know, for decades. So I thought that was important to incorporate. My husband was super on board with it. So that's just what we have in our house and our kids are used to it. And sometimes my middle one complains because he likes to game a lot. No, none of my friends have these restrictions. You know why we have them. Let's go through. And now he's 13. Let's go through the science. And we talk about it. You've got a family history of myopia. Your grandfather had retinal detachments. Your aunt had a retinal detachment. I don't want you to become myopic. So let's go.
No, all important things there for sure. Now, are you also interested in doing the atropine, the low dose atropine? So you mentioned 2 hours of outdoor time, limiting screen time.
And we do. So all three of my kids, so my husband is a high myope and has a family history of a lot of RDs. And so all three of my kids are on prophylactic low dose atropine since they were 8 to 10 years old, even before the latest study came out, which shows it can help prevent myopia. I saw the signs and I figured there was very little harm in starting it. So I started, and I offer it to patients too, even before, this is off, it's an off-label medication anyway. Literature looks like this. If you want to try it, we can do it. So thankfully, actually, none of my kids are nearsighted yet. So surprisingly.
Yeah. What's the dosing? What's the concentration? It's really low.
So
right?
Usually I'll start with 0.05%, but in a place like Hawaii, it's quite bright. So sometimes they were complaining about the light sensitivity. So I've dropped all of my kids now to 0.025.
So yeah, really, really low dose.
Yes, it's super low dose. I mean, that's almost homeopathy, but it's not. So
well, obviously proof's in the pudding there. If you got a 15-year-old in high school, which is a lot of near time studying.
A lot, and a lot of YouTubing. So
I mean, listen, if you compare me to your kids, I'm far, far worse. I'm like, my screen time is through the roof sometimes just sitting here.
Me too. And that's the other thing. I mean, since my kids are younger, I have to be really mindful about my screen time use in front of them, because I can't tell them, get off your phone, let's interact. If I'm on my phone, I'm doing work, right? We use our phones for a lot of work, for emailing, for me, for content creation. But I try to be mindful about doing it in the morning or in the evenings when they're asleep, so that they, you know, they just see those, like, modeling better habits for them too. But it's, your kids are older. You can be on your device as long as you want.
Well, my kids don't listen to me. That's easy. So my only job is pay the bills and stay out of the way. That's my entire goal. It's easy. I've learned it's easier that way for me. But do we find out in the future, in 10 or 20 years, that like today's social media was like yesteryear's smoking or something?
I mean, that's there's so many benefits of it, right? You and I educate on it, but I see the negative consequences too, for sure. So, and especially taking care of children, I see that in specific subsets of population where it can affect the mental health, where it can just feed into that dopamine cycle for those neurodivergent kids, right? I don't know. Not to be down on social media, a lot of benefits, but it's interesting some of those countries that are going 16 and up, right?
Right. So talk about that. So now I guess it was Australia, right? Which says no social media for kids under age 16.
Under age 16. And then we were in DC and we saw all these ads from Instagram in bus stops about the parental controls as well, for just starting to address the concerns that parents have.
Some of these apps though, they just know how to just hit my dopamine. I like cars and this, whatever things I like, it's like bam, 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 just hit me with it. I could sit here for an hour scrolling Insta and I don't even realize an hour's going by.
For sure. That's the thing. And it's interesting because I do. So my husband will, I think, tend to scroll more than I do because I'm thinking like it's work for me. So categorize it that way. But I can see my son and he's looking at interesting things. But I remember his eighth grade teachers literally wrote in his school assessment, Nikhil's doing great, except for he's always on YouTube in the middle of class. Other times he's watching things that I myself find interesting. That's what the teacher said. But he needs to learn. I try to redirect him. I mean, literally, he was known as the kid that watched YouTube, like in class, constantly, the time. So it's going to be really interesting. I love the idea of these cafes that don't allow phones. Because think about it, even when you go stand in line for your coffee, we're all on our phones. I think I forgot my phone once and it was just kind of neat to look around. I was at dinner waiting for my husband. I forgot my phone. He was running late from a patient. The bartender came over and was like, hey, I just saw you were waiting. And just sat down and talked with me. You lose that all those actual in-world, in-person interactions that we used to have, not denigrating online interactions or online friends, which I totally think
there's a balance.
Yeah, it's a balance. Yeah. The balance.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah, for me, I like now when I go to a restaurant, I'm like, let me just leave the phone in the car. Let me just actually enjoy the experience of going out to dinner and the conversation. And
I love that. When my kids are older, I'm totally going to do that. We still have to keep it with us because we leave them at home. But when they're out of the house, for sure. Or if I'm at a meeting, I'm definitely just, I don't even like when people put it face down on the table. I think that that's still.
Get off the table even, right? For sure.
Yeah. Yeah,
completely. I've also learned that. I studied all my metrics. I mean, for Cataract Coach, I'm more than 1 million views a month. So it's a lot of views.
Wow, amazing. Yeah,
I know if I show a video on YouTube, I show every day it's the same on all my platforms. So the same content will be on YouTube, Facebook, Insta, LinkedIn, and the works. On the cataractcoach.com website. On YouTube, I have to show something good within about 30 seconds. Otherwise, my decay rate goes a little bit.
For sure.
On Insta, I have 3 seconds.
Yes, exactly. 3 seconds. That's it. It's it.
My gosh. It's like...
And it's shorter and shorter.
Yeah, it's the same video that I put, but on Insta, I have to fast forward it to like 3 seconds right before like the action spot, the something that happens to get someone's attention.
That hook has to be in the first 3 seconds on Insta or on TikTok or on all of these other apps. Our attention spans are definitely getting shorter. And I think a lot about it because my youngest daughter seems to have the most difficulty with sustained attention. Like, is it just because she's been exposed to her world is different 5 years later?
Yeah, I think it's our culture that we have now. It's a different world.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a soapbox I can get on all day long because it's really interesting. And for me, of course, being on social media, but also wanting to limit it. None of my children have it. My 15-year-old, we offered it to him now. It's like, did you want Snapchat or Insta? He's like, no, not really. I'm like, okay, fine.
Awesome. Well, maybe also your kids have your ultra high energy. You are super high energy. The things you do, because we didn't even get into this conversation yet, but you have other projects and that's you started a medical meeting.
Yeah.
You have online businesses. Let's talk about some of this because I'm amazed at the amount of things you do. It is unbelievable.
So, I mean, the big one is what started as a women's medical conference. I started in 2019 with two other women, a OBGYN and a reproductive endocrinologist. And now that's transformed. We actually got our joint accreditation. So we can now accredit other people's courses, conferences. You want people to, I mean, you're geared towards more trainees, but if they're out, if you want CME to be given for your podcast, we can do that. You know, it's really now elevated into something more where we have a membership for people. You can just reflect on any content. So if someone is just watching your content, they can join our membership and reflect on it, say, oh, done. I got a half a credit for just watching Cataract Coach's video, which is true. I mean, we're learning all the time. So why don't we get credit for it?
Yeah. Well, the neat part is while I think a lot of my audience is ophthalmologists in their 30s and 40s. We get comments posted every day from ophthalmologists in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. So I run the full gamut. In fact, some of my most ardent fans are ophthalmologists who are older than me. It's just been incredible learning. I can't believe how much they like the format of 5 minutes a day.
I love that. I mean, it's bite size. It hits it hard. It's high yield, which is what people want. We don't have a lot of time, so it's so good. You should be giving CE credit for that.
Yeah, you know, that's a possibility. We could maybe look into doing that in the future if people want it.
They don't even have to. They can just, if they join our membership, it's not anything.
Tell me, what's the name of your organization?
Pinnacle. So that's, we got our little Pinnacle logo right there.
You can send me a link. I'll put it below in the podcast.
Yeah, that'd be great. So they can join our membership and it's $250 for a year and they can reflect on whatever they're watching. You, if they're listening to your podcast in the car, walking the dog, they just have to fill out the reflection form. We give them the CME certificate for it because that's actually a accredited way, though a lot of medical education companies do not use the reflection feature to get, because I think it's just hard to manage. So we figured out a way to create a learning management system to manage it because we're all digital educators and we know that's where people are going online. They aren't necessarily going to, you and I, when we go to the meetings, we're speaking or it's the networking, it's the side conversations, right? It's not necessarily attending a conference or a talk that we learn from, but we're always learning. So why not other people do the same? Yeah.
Well, for me, I'm overdosed on CME. I've lectured in 20.
Yes, countries. Exactly. For sure.
It's already too much. But do you also have meetings in person?
We do. We have a meeting every May in Austin, Texas. So that one is women's, just multi-specialty women's medical conference. And it's across all different not just physicians, but physician assistants, psychologists, dentists. So it's open to any woman in healthcare, which is neat because a lot of us are facing some of the same situations. If you are starting a practice, dentists do it very well. Dentists are very smart.
Yeah.
They are so smart. So why not learn from the dentist from Idaho, right? And I think about when I was creating the meeting with my two co-founders, what is it that I'm interested in, especially now in my late 40s, 48? I'm not necessarily interested in hearing just how an ophthalmologist does it. I want to know, how does someone else do it? How do they make it work with their patients or within their structure? Or how do they gain a leadership position at their academic institution when everybody else is met? Like, these are the questions, and they're not specific to our specialty. So we thought that's across, you know, that peer-to-peer connection, which really is pretty amazing. And people become friends and they fly across the country to see each other's practices, which they've done this past year. It's pretty awesome to see that, to witness how they're all growing in really different ways and just empowering them to stay in medicine. You don't have to leave medicine to be able to get what you want, to juggle and manage and fit your work and your life and your kids. You can stay in medicine. Just let's see a different way to do it than maybe what you've been taught.
Right. It's like the neatest crossover, I think, between dentistry and ophthalmology is Charles Kellman, who says he was in his dentist chair, right, getting ultrasonic teeth cleaned.
Yep. Like,
why don't we use this in the eye? And you know, he's changed the world.
Changed. That's absolutely the world. Right. Yep. Exactly. That's where the innovation comes.
Yeah. Just seeing things a little differently, for sure.
Yep. Absolutely. So
what could we bring, right, to share with other specialties, and what can we learn from them?
Exactly.
That sounds amazing. And of course, the website too. I like the idea of, the reflection method of CME, which would be great.
That's the way people are learning. So that's why we thought, let's just make it easy for people to get the CME credit. I mean, if they need it. I mean, if the person in Louisiana does not want to fly all across the country for Academy, then they can get their 30 CMEs by watching your videos.
Right. Well, the other part is some of the trips are like for you to go to the next Academy in Orlando. From Oahu.
Yep.
From Honolulu to somewhere on the mainland, then another big flight across the country.
Yep. It's time away from my kids, which is, that's my number one time away from my practice. These are not 2-hour trips. These aren't trips I can do. And people forget that. When I just went to DC for the American Academy as a spokesperson to speak at a congressional briefing, they said, if you need to come straight to the meeting, it's like, no, I always have to take a red eye to get to the East Coast. Right. There's no way around it. So I will. Sometimes I can make it, but usually those red eyes land later. So I'm going to have to fly in the day before. So it's just, it's a different way of thinking of it.
You took your son to that meeting.
I did. Had a great time. He loved being able to just see the inner workings and to meet some of our actual representatives for, you know, congressmen for Hawaii. It was pretty special. And for them to mentor him in that way was really pretty cool for him.
Yeah, I think it's so important to maximize that time with the family now, because as you know, a couple of years, he's gone. He's probably gone. Not going to the university next to mom. He's going to go to the mainland somewhere.
No. They all say they're going to the mainland. So I have 7 years at the most for my last one to graduate. Yeah. So I'd rather stay a little bit closer to home, maximize the time. I enjoy doing these side projects. I think that, once you get to this certain point in your career, not that surgery is easy. We give our time and attention or clinic to our patients every day, but we're not learning the basics anymore. So we've got more brain space to do other things. And that also allows me to have some flexibility in my work schedule to be able to do the afternoon pickups and to take them to all the different things. So that's been fun.
That's very cool. Now you run some online businesses. Tell me about that.
So I have with another friend a little mommy and me clothing company. So these are two kind of passion projects, which I thought were, that one was just,
I love it.
It's been really fun. Stuff is all cotton, organic from India, hand block printed. Mm-hmm. And we work with very small manufacturers in India that are doing everything, not in sweatshops. And we know what the conditions are like. And then just for branding purposes, they started it as something just more for my clinic to start a little reading glass line, which is a white label reading glasses where I'm able to make better, you know, readers for women that don't want to just buy the random ones that are at CVS or Costco or Walmart. They want something a little bit more fashionable, but they want the lens quality, right? That's what people would say is I'd be at dinner with my friends and we're all wearing our plus 150s or 175s now. And they would, wait, why are yours so much clearer than mine are? Well, because I got Zeiss lenses of mine. So
optical qualities, right? That matters.
Exactly. People don't realize that, right?
So you run that business too then?
I do. So that one is almost going to be completely folded into my clinic now and just stay on island because I have limited time. So I don't have a ton of time to really promote that. But it was good to just build up the brand recognition for it and then be able to sell it here in state, which is good.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, how do you do time management? It seems like with so many projects, you've got three kids, you got the family situation, you've got your public persona, you've got a busy practice, you're mentoring other people, you've got your pinnacle society here, you're starting an online business. When do you have time to come up for air? How do you manage all that?
So I have a lot of, as you know, energy, which I think exhausts
very
my
high
husband. But yeah, I also I subscribe to two things, which I think are super important. I outsource a ton. I have a lot. I have an executive virtual assistant. So you were CC'd on her, Claire. Yeah. She lives in Kansas City. She is a mom of four, and she just helps with so many things that I don't need to do, right? I don't need to book my hotel at Academy. I don't need to choose restaurants. You know, it's fun, but I don't need to do those things. She handles a lot of stuff, even for my office. If my office manager if she's out of town, she'll just handle a lot of the higher level admin aspects of the practice. So she is fantastic. I am very big into outsourcing. I have a housekeeper that comes once a week. You know, I will do all the things. If this something does not give me joy, and I really look at my time as being my absolute most valuable asset. It's not money.
Yeah.
Money, you can re-earn money. I cannot regain this time. I have to invest in my health or into my family and to my kids. That's my like top priority. So when people ask me for things, I'm also very careful about when I say yes to even simple like podcasts or this, or like, is there a personal reason I want to do this? Is this going to advance whatever is my goal for the year or for the month? So I'm thinking about it like that. And then I follow Pareto's principle, 80-20 rule. Do you know that one?
Sure.
Love that. So, you know, 20% of your efforts give you 80% of your results. And you just have to find out what is that 20% of your efforts. And then I let the rest go. So there's stuff that is falling apart in our house, but it is low on the totem pole of what needs to be done. It'll get done eventually at some point, but it's not high yield right now. So that stuff goes. And then there's chaos this week. My daughter has walking pneumonia. I've had to pick her up from school twice from the health center. One day I just rushed in, got in the car because I was working from home. I had no shoes. Now in Hawaii, actually, that's not a big problem.
Right, right.
They don't really care, but it just kind of speaks to like, I'm not all there. Sometimes it's so chaotic. I'm driving to school with no shoes on. So
stop at ABC Markets, pick up some flip-flops, $10. Yes.
Actually on school, you don't even have to have shoes. It wasn't all that. I told the kids, they were like, oh, that's fine, mom. Some of the Hawaiian teachers never wear shoes either. I'm like, great. Okay.
that's an awesome culture. So how do you find this virtual assistant? Was this like some online service? Or
through Upwork. And if you've used Upwork before, found her. Oh my gosh. You've got to use Upwork. I also have a virtual person that edits my YouTube videos. I've got a virtual social media assistant who will cross-post things for me or will like, oh, where's that audio? Like I did something with a modem dial-up earlier this week. Like you need, if you recognize the sound, it's time for your first pair of reading glasses thing. I'm not going to search for that. I text her, Amanda, find me a modem dial-up audio that I can use for this. But you know, you can have other people doing all the things for you. So Upwork, the best
way.
So I found Claire on Upwork. I think just finished the leadership development program for Academy. When one of the meetings I was talking about Claire, my executive virtual assistant, we have five virtual assistants in the office too. We have virtual scribes, virtual medical receptionists. That's a whole nother talk that I could give. Actually, I'm speaking about it.
Giving the upcoming Hawaiian Eye.
Yes, that's the one I'm giving. Yep. at Hawaiian Eye.
I saw that on the calendar. I was like, I better start. I was like, I have to see this one.
Yes. So, but when I spoke about Claire and the things that she does for me, that just takes stuff off my plate. Think about just all the things like in your head. And so even, I'm going to be honest, and I'm hoping my mom doesn't listen to this podcast, but I'm dropping the kids off. I'm like, shoot, it's my mom's birthday. I'm at the stop sign. I send Claire a text message. Send my mom $200 worth of flowers. She has a master spreadsheet that I helped her create. She's got my mom's address. She knows what her favorite flowers are. I have created this whole spreadsheet. So she also knows what hotels I like, which points are, where's my flying reward thing. She knows all of this. She can do everything. By the time I got to my office, because what's going to happen? I get in, I get first patient, right? You barely put your bag down. You're done. You're boom, boom, boom. Yeah. It's noon. And you know, I'm 6 hours behind. I've missed my mom's birthday. By the time I was done with my first patient, my mom texted me a picture, selfie with the flowers.
Oh, okay? that is so wild.
That is how I, you know, that's how you do it, because it would have been on my list. I'd have made a checklist. Then I would have had to remember to order. Then I had put my credit card. She's got access. I mean, this is after years of making sure of vetting her, but she has got access to my credit cards and my checking accounts and all of that. So she can do the things I need her to do.
Just make things happen.
Yeah.
Well, now, tell me in your clinic now, you give me a little preview at least of your Hawaiian Eye talk that's coming up about how you have so many virtual assistants in your clinic.
So it's my husband and I'm in clinic only part-time. Now he's there full-time. We have two optometrists as well who are there full-time who really function very high yield. They're wonderful. So we've got a lot of in-person staff. We have three receptionists. I have an office manager, two opticians, about five COAs, COT kind of people. And then for each of the doctors, so we have three virtual scribes. So in total, and they prep charts. So they will go through, pull everything forward. They will electronically prescribe. They will send faxes. They will look at the faxes and input the patient. Oh, doctor, you know, I sent to the retina doctor. Retina doctor did laser, retinopexy 360 at 10 o'clock. They put that into the chart. They upload everything. They send my letters to the pediatricians or to the referring doctors. So they are doing all the behind. And then they're also just remoting in during the exam room. So we don't have a physical scribe in the room because oftentimes they're just standing. I mean, they don't need to be there. So if I'm okay, two plus, and they know because we've trained them. Again, it's an onboarding process and it takes a while to train people. I think people that think that they can't use a virtual assistant, it's because they haven't trained them properly. So if I say mine specifically, you know, XT35, APCT22, you know, they know where to put all that information for Jeff's patients. If he says, I don't know, whatever, what are you corny people? You know, the answer is two plus uveitis, whatever, PCS.
then these assistants have obviously ophthalmology training, no?
So they don't. But they're in the Philippines. So four of them are in the Philippines. We have a medical receptionist also. So in Hawaii also, we have a lot of a large Filipino population, but they all speak very good English. We did video calls before I hired them. Most of them have a pharmacy background. They're trained pharmacists in their country, which is why they're comfortable doing the electronic prescriptions. And, you know, they have a medical background, but not ophthalmology. So we taught them. That's the training. But I pretty much train everybody because in Hawaii, there's no COA or COT program in the state. So I train. I always hire for work ethic. Always and personality.
Yeah, for sure.
I can, and if their ability to their willingness to learn.
Enthusiasm,
If they can do that, I can teach them everything else and they're trained the way I like it. The few times we hire someone that came, you know, military, they moved and they worked for Dr. X and Y over there and they're never trained the way I want them. And they're never trained the level that I require of my staff. The customer service.
You're right.
Yeah. So this is what we do. And then we have a virtual medical receptionist. We've had patients bring the virtual medical receptionist donuts. And she said, oh, Charisse was so helpful. She squeezed me in for my appointment. She sounded Filipino. So I brought some Filipino like donuts for her. Yeah. We just text her or they bring wine. I mean, we text pictures. Thanks, Charisse.
Is it like an iPad sitting there with her face, basically? What is it?
No, so it's a soft phone. So when you internet, call. Right? Yeah. When someone calls our office to make an appointment. She answers.
Oh, so I got to wrap my head on this. So they call your number, some 808 Hawaiian number,
yep.
Clinic number. It automatically is answered in the Philippines.
If it's just to make an appointment, if they're trying to get directed to the surgical coordinator or to the optician or to make a contact lens order, then it is here. Actually, our contact lens person is in Las Vegas. She's the sister-in-law of the of our office manager. So she takes all of those and she just addresses. Yeah, but the one in the Philippines, she'll answer the phone and slot them in. So I just tried to think, what do I need in Hawaii especially? I mean, we all had this with the pandemic. Difficulty hiring staff, right? But in Hawaii, especially because we're a closed community, our unemployment before the pandemic was only at 2%. It is hard to hire. It's hard to hire. And I want to support our local community and our local economy. I always hire in person when possible. But we had staff shortages. So I told my husband and our office manager, we need to think outside the box a little bit and figure this out because we need help. I can't have 200 charts a day. He can't have 300 charts that he hasn't closed out yet because he's so behind, right?
Well, that's just genius. That makes me want to take a long drive and just think about this. What could I be doing to outsource more and more? Because you're right. I have a finite amount of time left per day, per week, per year, and for life. I only have X number of hours left.
And we should be making the high-level decisions, not the low-level decisions, right? So if it's a low-level decision, the other thing that's very helpful, have you ever heard of Eisenhower's Matrix?
No, what's Eisenhower's Matrix? I have no idea.
So it talks about, it builds everything into quadrants and time and decision-making and time and what type of things should you be doing? Should you just get it off your list? Is this it helps you focus in on that 80-20. What's your 20%? You should be only doing the things that are the high yield, high decision-making things that only you can do. If somebody else can do it, that should be a somebody else thing. If you can hire them, that should be a somebody else thing.
Right. Like in my clinic, I could answer the phone, but should I? No.
Exactly. There's another, I can't remember. It's in Cal Newport. He has a phrase for that. We probably answer the phones better than the receptionist, right? Because we know this is actually an urgency. This needs to be scheduled today. This can wait a month. We know that. Yet, we still have people that answer the phones for us. So you have to apply that to everything.
So I should focus on surgery because no one else can do surgery.
No one else can do your surgery. No one else can do your surgeries.
Yeah, I guess we do that to an extent. Like in my clinic, for LASIK, it's not my refraction. I have two optometrists who are amazing. It's their refraction.
Yeah.
I'll do the surgery, but based on their data.
But then what I started doing is not just what you should be doing, but then I looked at my staff to maximize their, not just efficiency, but their productivity. I said, make a list of all the things that you're doing. And then I'm going to look at, because my office manager was having a hard time. She couldn't get everything done. It's like, make a list of what you're doing. I'm going to look at that list. And then we're going to decide what we can outsource that you're doing. That doesn't need to be done by you. That can be outsourced to or even just delegated to someone downstream for you, right? And then when everyone is maximized, they are happier because they're doing the things they are skilled at and also truly bring value to the practice.
Wow, that makes so much sense. Yeah, of course. Everyone should work at their top of their ability and not do things that they see as a waste of their time or not efficient, et cetera. They shouldn't do those.
No. I mean, then it applies for home too. So I will have someone that cooks dinner once a week for us. I love to cook. I'm a good cook. And I think for certain things, I'm a better cook than she. She's an excellent cook. She'll make dumplings and things from scratch. But my time is best served helping my kids with their homework, spending time with them. She can't do that. She can do the laundry. She can clean the house. I could also do those things, but my time is best served in a different way. And that's when I just realized it can be even applied everywhere.
Right, except when the kid's homework becomes too challenging.
Okay, that's true. With your kid now for 10 years.
You're like, I don't know anymore.
Yeah, honors Alge too. I lasted 2 chapters and then I got him a tutor.
I did the same thing. Or, you soon realize how much you forget.
But totally.
Well, what great advice. I'm telling you, I learn a lot from these podcasts. I'm so thankful you're doing this podcast. I'm getting a lot out of this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. It's been fun.
Well, these are great pearls for a young ophthalmologist. So I think let's kind of recap. What are the best pearls here for young ophthalmologists? You're finishing your training. You're 30-ish. Finish your residency, fellowship, whatever. You're going to start in practice. And you want to, the hardest thing ever, which we see in our field, is start a family, start a practice, yes, start a home all at the same time. It seems so daunting.
All at the same time. Add into it, I moved 6,000 miles away and we bought a practice and bought a home and got pregnant all within 12 months and got married.
Oh my God, that's so stressful.
It's super stressful. And I think that really it's 80-20. You've got to figure out what really pushes the needle forward in your business. Okay, you got to get on the insurance plans. You got to build, you know, you have to focus on that. And then you can create a longer term plan for the marketing or for the community outreach or whatever else it is. And you have to phase it out and not feel like you need to do it all right then and right there. So we didn't do any community outreach in, you know, the first 6 months. We were just trying to get our head above water, right? To get patients to understand how to pay and you know, manage staff. And then I started putting together CE talks for optometrists. I started visiting, you know, internists and pediatricians. I'd had my baby by then. I took my baby with me and we went and made, I brought lunch and so like, hey, and they remember me. They still remember, oh, you brought your baby when you came. Nobody does that, right? So it's, you can build it in. You don't have to do all the things at one time, I think, but you've got to make sure you're doing the high yield things first. And then I think even as a newly graduated trainee, we have a tendency not to really value our time. We just don't, right? Because we're poor. Yeah. We don't have any money when we're in med school. So we will, you know, spend hours doing something which doesn't make a lot of economic sense because we don't have the money. And you have to really start thinking about it. Actually, even when you're a student, you're paying, I don't know how much med school costs nowadays, but $50,000, $60,000, that's still, you can think of it as your 80, salary.
80 or 90.
Jeez. But that's still your time. You should be treating it almost like a job. You're getting paid to study. So is it worth it to do X, Y, Z if you don't? If there's another option, and I know for some people it's not financially feasible, but as a young attending, you can forego. We did not buy a lot of things. We had very, very inexpensive cars. You know, I don't have a lot of material possession. I don't have a second vacation home, but I will always pay to outsource and save time, hands down. And I think that just makes me happier.
Yeah, you also said something very important, which I didn't realize until way into my career, is the ability or power of saying no.
No. 100. So I have this little cheat sheet. I'll send it to you if you want to put it. It's like a one pager. It's questions I created when I was mentoring medical students. Is this a hell yes? Right. That's the first question. You ask me to do this. That's a hell yes. I'm going to do it. I will make time to do this because I enjoy speaking with you. I knew it'd be fun. And it does this advance your goals? And then it goes through these questions to ask yourself, because people don't think about when they say yes to something, they then have to say no to something else. You think you can squeeze it all in. You just can't. You are then saying no to working out, maybe. You're then saying no to spending dinner with your family, right? You have to think, so the last question is, what am I giving up to say yes to this? Right. So a little bit of sleep. I had to get up earlier today so I could work out before this. And normally I'd work out right now. So there is a trade-off. So it just makes you think about the trade-offs. I'll send you the little one page.
I would love to figure that stuff's so valuable. It's like, yep. I wish I had some sort of guidelines like that when I was younger. But now I've realized for me, the easiest is to say, hey, it sounds like a great project. Yeah. But at the moment, I don't have the bandwidth to give your project the time it deserves. And for that reason, I have to kindly say no, but I wish you the best of the project.
That's exactly what I do. I call it the yes, no, yes sandwich.
Oh, I didn't even realize I said that. But
you know, because you're grateful for the opportunity. I know your conference is going to be a huge success. Unfortunately, to be able to honor the commitments that I've already made, I'm going to have to pass on this, but best of luck, blah, you know.
Yeah, and I mean it very sincerely. It's just
absolutely. But it just makes you think instead of just without thinking a thoughtless yes, because you just feel pressured. You feel like you should. It just makes you really think about the things that are coming across your email or in person asks. All of that. It's your time, and just people need to start valuing their time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of them, when they're in an employed model, their time's not valued. You're asked to answer intramails and charts and this and that, right? And so a lot of times your time's not valued, and then you start to not value your time as well, and your time is valuable.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, my father passed away recently, and his only regret in life, he had a great life, so good man. His only regret in life was, he says, he wished he didn't work his fingers to the bone in his 50s and 60s. He says, for what? So then I'm 85 and I can look in the bank account, has a little extra debt. Who cares?
Yes, who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? Yeah. Agreed.
I just said the heart. I was like, you know what? Okay. At 52, I retired from teaching residents. Yeah. And I changed gears. I do the cataract coach things now. I travel the world. And it's much easier now with grown kids. It's so easy to, like, okay, they live in different cities. They're not even in the state. So I can just be free. If I want to go to this meeting in Brazil, which I was last weekend, I'm going. Let's have a good time.
Yes.
And so it's on my own terms. Yeah. Wow. What great pearl. This has been such an incredible podcast. We didn't talk too much technical off the module. Which I love, actually. No,
we didn't. Adjustable suture technique, but that's fine.
We can learn that somewhere else. The pearls in this hour are so killer. I mean, I literally took notes. The first thing I did was like, okay, what is this Upwork? I mean, let me figure this out.
Oh, Upwork is the best. My son, I'm using it now. I use it for all sorts of things. My son's writing a children's book, my high schooler, and I found an illustrator. He found an illustrator through my account on Upwork. I mean, there's just, you can, everything.
I'm going to teach you right out. So, oh, Rupa, thank you for doing this. I really enjoyed this podcast. It's so valuable. I will put the links down below of your project, and also your special list of questions to ask yourself about any time. I love it. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me. It's hour flew by. It's been,
I can't even believe it. It's been an hour. We seemed like 10 minutes.
Yes.
Well, thanks again. And remember, for our listeners and viewers, I got a podcast, a new one every single week on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get your podcast. Of course, there's a Cataract Coach podcast. The top podcast is all about ophthalmology for a reason. And of course, every single day, a new Cataract Coach video. We're at 2,400 videos. I am an internet addict, yes, for sure. And a new video still every single day. So until next time, I'll catch you later.